Welcome to another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. What you're about to hear is the first of a series of powerful interviews that I'll co-host with Sabelle Edmonds. And if you don't know about Sabelle Edmonds, I am proud to be associated with her. She was working at the FBI as a translator after 9/11 and was fired after she blew the whistle on shenanigans going on in the translations department. Before that, she was fired from the FBI, and when she tried to tell her story to members of Congress and to courts, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft at the time, imposed a gag order under the fuzzy, murky state secret privilege. Sabelle operates a great website at 123realchange.blogspot.com, and I invite you to go there and read the information. Our first interview subject is James Bamford, the author of The Shadow Factory and the acknowledged expert on the National Security Agency, and we're going to talk about the domestic wiretapping and interception of your communications and much, much more. Our podcast series with Sabelle Edmonds is called The Boiling Frogs. Listen and let me know what you think. You can send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich, that's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows, but today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
I'm Peter B. Collins, delighted to co-host Boiling Frogs with Sabelle Edmonds. And our guest today is James Bamford. He's the best-selling author of Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, A Pretext for War, and his most recent book is a powerful look at the intelligence community and in particular the National Security Agency here in the United States. It's entitled The Shadow Factory and subtitled The Ultra-Secret NSA, From 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. And James Bamford also is a producer for PBS. He works on television documentaries for the Nova series. And he produced and was a major player on camera in the PBS Nova edition that aired on February 3rd of 2009, entitled The Spy Factory. Jim Bamford, welcome to our program today.
Well, thanks, Peter. I really appreciate being on with you and Sabelle.
Well, you have done an amazing job working with public information and on-the-record interviews to detail the incredible breadth, depth, and extent of the work of the National Security Agency. And it's come into sharper focus since 9/11 because of the what was called warrantless wiretapping, but I refer to it as illegal surveillance of American citizens that occurred based on a series of assertions from the Bush administration. And there were these sign-offs from the Attorney General. But fundamentally, I believe that they violated the Fourth Amendment and the FISA law. And that was cleaned up a little bit with the help of complicit Democrats in the summer of 2008 when they passed what were called FISA reforms. But, Jim, I'd like to start with a little anecdote. Over the 4th of July holiday, I had a chance encounter with Democratic Congressman Mike Thompson of California. We were at a wine tasting in the Napa Valley, and I had a brief conversation with him, and he is what's called a Blue Dog Democrat. He is also a member of the House Intelligence Committee. And I told him in a candid but blunt way, I said, Mike, I want my Fourth Amendment back. And he looked at me and kind of smiled and in a patronizing way said, sure, sure. And I said, no. I said, I am appalled at the extent of surveillance by our government. And I believe that they're getting everything, every telephone call, whether it's on a cell phone or Skype or a landline, and every email. I said, I don't know what they do with it, but I know they collect it all. Jim Bamford, was I correct in asserting the extent of the surveillance of Americans by the National Security Agency?
Well, I think so, and I think it's actually going to be getting much worse in the near future because NSA is expanding tremendously. The agency that nobody knows very much about yet is becoming the largest intelligence agency on Earth. It's already become the largest intelligence agency. It's soon to become even larger with the addition of this new cyber command that's being given to NSA. So both through the eavesdropping, the surveillance they do on incoming communications, and now this new charge of being in charge of the cyber wars and the cyber defense, the NSA is going to have more access to U.S. communications. So one example of how much information NSA is collecting is they've run out of space to store it all on NSA property, on Fort Meade. So they've had to build a brand new eavesdropping facility, or rather a storage place for all the eavesdropping tapes and all the communications that they're picking up in Texas. And they're also building another one in Utah now. So they're building these facilities to store enormous amounts of information that's being collected. The facility in Texas, for example, is almost the size of the Alamo Dome. And when you can squeeze so much information on just a small little thumb drive, you know, the size of a stick of gum practically, 2 to 4 gigabytes, you could figure out how much information they could store in these enormous places. Now, they wouldn't need that if they weren't picking up so much information that they had to store.
And, Jim, in addition to collecting all this data, as you detail in the book, they have very sophisticated systems that include data mining and even voice mining. So that, for example, in this conversation that we're having today, I would assume that this is being intercepted by the NSA. Now, there are billions of conversations going on on a daily basis, and they can't listen to each and every one. But if your voice, or my voice, or Sibel Edmonds' voice, is in their database, and they can identify the unique characteristics of each voice, then it's possible for them to essentially fast-forward through a lot of these recordings and pick out key individuals who they want to monitor. Am I correct?
Well, I think NSA would like to have that capability. I really don't think that they've achieved that technology yet. They're actually much less advanced technologically in terms of voice interception than most people realize. They're far more advanced in data interception, but voice is much more difficult. I interviewed a number of voice interceptors, voice intercept operators, for the book, for the Shadow Factory, and
that's Adrian Kinney and David Falk were
that's
two
right.
that appeared in the book.
Those are the two that were actually named in the book, but I actually interviewed a few other people that did similar type of work. And they explained exactly how it worked and how they intercepted these calls, and they said that among the calls that they intercepted were those between journalists and their spouses. So these involved personal conversations. A lot of them were bedroom conversations. These were people that were separated for many months, weeks, months at a time, and they're having intimate conversations. And Adrian was telling me how she felt very disgusted sitting there listening to those conversations and recording those conversations. And when she protested internally within the NSA, she was just told to keep doing her job. And then she protested to the Congress, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they did nothing until after my book came out, and then they finally started an investigation. But what they would do would be they sit in front of a monitor, and satellites would pick up all this information, and they put it into these basically like a box full of telephone calls, and they listen to one and they decide what to do with it, and then they listen to the next one, and there was a number of people that would be sitting there and going through these phone calls, and sitting at the monitor, they could see, usually they could see who's calling whom. They could see what telephone number is being called, and that telephone number would be identified by a name that would go with it. And again, a lot of these were not just journalists, but they were also soldiers over there in Iraq calling their families and their spouses and having conversations.
Well, and we know that Congresswoman Jane Harman was having a conversation that she's very embarrassed by, but it was intercepted by the NSA.
No, exactly. Well, that was, I think, because they were targeting the some Israeli secret agents of some sort, some agents for the Israeli government, and Jane Harman happened to be talking to one of the people who was being targeted by NSA, and her conversation got picked up. I mean, that would be more of a legitimate conversation, eavesdropping, if the NSA had a FISA warrant, basically, or even if they didn't, technically they wouldn't really need a FISA warrant if they were targeting a member of the Israeli embassy. You don't need a FISA warrant for that. So, but that is how they do a lot of the eavesdropping. They sit there with earphones on and they listen for phone calls. And in the years before George Bush came into office, the FISA law was very much in effect. And what Adrian Kinney told me was that they would immediately turn off the communications or switch to another phone call if they picked up a phone call that obviously was that of an American. And that's one of the reasons she was very angry and decided to become a whistleblower, was because she thought that what they were doing was a violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. She knew what that was, and she spent, I think it was 6 or 8 years doing this type of work for NSA before the before 9/11, before the change.
Jim, speaking of Israel, there is this information that I came across that most people don't know about. And I'm talking about two companies that happen to serve our two large telecom. Both of them have this very interesting Israel connection. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the things in my research for the book, I found, in looking exactly at how the NSA actually does its eavesdropping, I was really amazed at the fact that there's private companies that sort of act as go-betweens between the NSA and the telecom companies. The telecom companies, such as AT&T, don't actually do the eavesdropping themselves. And what they do is they have a facility on their switching in their switching building, such as the one in San Francisco, that's a very secret room, and it's put there by NSA. And then in that room is equipment that's made by software and hardware that's put there by a private company. In San Francisco, the name of the company is Naris. And the company that does the similar type of work that acts as sort of a buffer between the NSA and the and Verizon is another company.
Is that Ectel or VideoNet?
No, that's I just can't think of the name of it. Right,
Verint
now.
And Naris.
Those yeah, Verint.
Verint
is the company that actually does the work with Verizon, and then Naris does the work with AT&T. I mean, one of the interesting things about those companies is they both have ties to Israel. They were both founded by Israelis, and it's very worrisome, I think, when you have companies with ties to foreign countries are working in a very secret capacity. to eavesdrop on lots of communications and then have that communication be transmitted to NSA. So I was very surprised to find that virtually nobody in Congress knew that there was private companies with foreign, or at least that originated with foreign ties in foreign countries.
You point out in the book that many of these people also have a history with Unit 8200. Explain that, please.
Well, in doing a lot of research on Israeli intelligence, there is a Israeli equivalent of NSA, and it's called Unit 8200. And basically it does the same thing. It's involved in eavesdropping, code-breaking, interception of communications, that kind of thing. And it's a very, very secret organization in Israel. And one of the things that a number of the former senior officials, including directors of the organization, have said is that they try very hard to place their employees or former employees in corporations overseas to collect intelligence. One of the big dangers here, which is something I also found by discovering a Australian document, it was actually a transcript of a meeting that was taking place, a very secret meeting in Australia where they were discussing the whole issue of Barron's cooperation with the Australian eavesdropping organization. Barron is being used there just like they're being used in the United States. And what really shocked the Australian government officials was the fact that they were having a very difficult time accessing the intercepted communications in their own database. Yet they discovered that Barron was able to access that same information from outside the country, presumably from Israel. And the meeting was to decide whether they were going to get rid of Barron or not, and they called Barron employees and asked them about it, and they said that because of the protests by the Australian government, they didn't want to lose the contract. They said that they were not going to do that anymore, not going to access the database from outside the country anymore. So that's very worrying. I mean, if they could do it in Australia, they might be able to do it in the United States. And, again, we're dealing with very sensitive information that should not be so easily accessible to foreign countries.
Right.
There's
another angle here, and that is the former head of the company, Barron. Can you tell us about this man?
Sure, yeah. Barron is very interesting. It was formed by an Israeli and but a few years ago, there was an indictment that came out in New York indicting him for financial fraud and indicting a number of other senior officials from the same company for financial fraud. And the president of the company decided that he didn't want to face the indictment, and he fled to Israel and then fled to Namibia from there. So the problem you have is that you not only have these companies that are basically the go-betweens between NSA and the telecom companies in terms of intercepting information, you not only have them having foreign ties or foreign connections, you also have them, with questionable veracity. Here you have the president and the top officials of the company being indicted and one fled to Africa, the others pled guilty. So,
and you're referring to Kobe Alexander, who was the chairman of Verint and CEO of Comverse, and he also he didn't quite pack his bags. He wired $57 million back to Israel before he exited the United States.
Yeah, he told the Kobe Alexander told the FBI, he was just going to go over there for a little vacation, and then he would come back and deal with the indictment. I don't know why they let him go, but he sent over a little nest egg, a little bit more than the average vacation takes, $57 million or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I usually take some traveler's checks, but...
well, Well, actually, the money was very useful for him because he got to Israel and he was very worried about extradition, although Israel very reluctantly and a lot of times doesn't at all extradite Americans who are living in Israel. He was worried that they may extradite him, so he fled to Namibia. And then he used a lot of that money down there. They did arrest him at one point, but he used a lot of that money to sort of bribe the government in a way. He gave lots of money to government projects, gave lots of money to government officials, gave a lot of money to worthy charities down there and so forth. So he really ingratiated himself financially with the country, and as a result, the country changed its extradition policy, and thus far has prevented him from being extradited.
Jim Bamford, in your book, you sum it up in a single sentence. Thus, virtually the entire American telecommunications system is bugged by two Israeli-formed companies with possible ties to Israel's eavesdropping agency with no oversight by Congress. Now, this is problematic on the surface. Obviously, the outsourcing of these very sensitive intelligence efforts creates a myriad of problems. There's also an issue of perception that when information like this becomes public, it adds to the perception in the Arab and Muslim worlds that the U.S. and Israel are essentially in league in challenging the Muslim and Arab governments.
Well, exactly. I think it's a very, at the same time we're trying to improve our image in the Muslim world, we have things like this going on. And the problem really is the oversight. Congress has just totally shirked its responsibility in terms of oversight. Recent report in the last few days about the director of the CIA, Panetta, has come out and said that admitted that the CIA over the last 8 years has withheld things from Congress, and Congress has never been very aggressive in going after this information. So, problem is there's virtually no oversight over a lot of the most serious violations that have taken place in the last 8 years.
That's right. And I want to go back to the civil liberties implication on the political side. Still, with all these grim realities and all the known facts, you get so many people, unfortunately the majority, who still say, well, why should I care? I don't have anything to hide, so it doesn't affect me. This is all about security, safety, and it involves terrorists. What do you tell those people, Jim?
Well, I say it does involve them because the NSA's capability to intercept information is grown tremendously. They not only do the interception of information, but they're doing the data mining, going through everybody's communications, looking for indications that they may be a terrorist. And then once that happens, then they're placed on these indelible watch list. Just for an example, you could be an average person that's never had anything to do with terrorism or anything like it, living in Paducah, Illinois, or someplace, and you may have moved into this house, and the person before that lived there before had a subscription to Al Jazeera. You know, they may have made a few phone calls to various places in the Middle East, Pakistan, and other places. And you put a few other factors in there, what time the calls are made and so forth, and all of a sudden that person fits into an algorithm that fits into a computer. In other words, this is a program that's looking for patterns. And that person may have moved away 2 weeks ago, and now you're living there, but that address is still linked with a suspicious person. And now your name is put on the watch list because you're living there and it's associated with that address. So you may not have any, nobody may knock on your door and put you in jail, but the bad things that could happen are things like you have a son or a daughter that may want to go to Annapolis or West Point, where the service academy. and they have fantastic grades and everything's going for them, but they get turned down, and it may be because one of the service academies checked the names against the watch list, and so the person doesn't get in. Or you're trying to get a small business administration job, you know, start a small business, and you get turned down even though you're fully qualified, and you never know, but it may be because, you know, of this algorithm that placed you in a suspicious spot on the watch list. So, again, they're building these enormous data facilities for something. I mean, they didn't have them 8 years ago, and they have them today. And because they're collecting so much stuff and they're data mining, they're looking through it all. And there are so many mistakes on this watch list. I mean, Ted Kennedy was on there for, I think, 2 or 3 months before he could get off, and, you know, well-known senator. So some people are on the list, and they don't get put on the do-not-travel list, the do-not-fly list. And so they'll never know that they're actually on the list, and they may have these adverse things happen to them, such as, you know, as I mentioned, small business administration loans or the son or daughter not getting into a service academy. There's a lot of possibilities, and these are things that people don't think about.
Well, and under the Patriot Act, they could use a national security letter with all of the gags that those impose. To check library records, bank accounts, credit cards, all based on these kinds of suspicions. And Jim Bamford, to make it a little more personal to you, you were a plaintiff, among others, in an ACLU suit that was brought in Detroit and heard by U.S. District Court Judge Anna Diggs Taylor. And to her credit, she ruled against the government in her lower court ruling and then stayed that decision. This was regarding the illegal programs and the violation, the clear violations of the FISA law. And take the narrative from there about what happened with this critical case as it went up the appeals process.
Well, Peter, as you mentioned, she did have a very, I thought it was an extremely well-written and well-thought-out opinion that was in the favor of the ACLU. And as you mentioned, I was one of the plaintiffs in that case. But what happened after that was that it went to an appeals court, a three-member appeals court in Cincinnati. And the problem with the makeup of that appeals court was that there were two members, two of the three members of that court were appointed by the Bushes, one by George Bush Sr. and one by George W. Bush, and then one member was appointed by the, I think it was by President Carter, I think it was. So so it was fairly, you know, before the decision ever came down, we pretty much figured what it would be, and it turned out to be just as we expected. It was 2-1 against it. Interestingly enough, both in the lower court with Anna Diggs Taylor, she ruled on the substance of the case, in other words, saying that the government was, what the government was doing was illegal, and the one judge on the appeals court case that favored our side also ruled on the substance of the case, saying that what the government was doing was illegal. The other two judges on the appeals court, the two that were appointed by the Bushes, instead ruled on a sort of a side issue, which was whether we have standing to bring the case. In other words, there was no way we could actually prove that the NSA was eavesdropping our communications, and, you know, they keep that totally top secret, and they never let any of that information out. They didn't rule on the substance. They just ruled on the issue of standing, and as a result of that, you know, we lost in the appeals court. We appealed to the Supreme Court, and they denied certiorari, so it went back to the appeals court, so it meant we lost the case. But, you know, it was a good try, and I'm glad the ACLU did it, and the two judges who did rule on the substance both found in our favor.
And Jim, what you just described is a legal gambit that has been used repeatedly by the Bush administration and now is being utilized and even expanded by the Justice Department under President Obama. And that is to claim that since you have no proof that you were illegally surveilled, you have no standing to bring a case. And, of course, under state secrets privileges and the other assertions that I find extra constitutional, they repeatedly are able to shut down these cases without the substantive issues being heard, even with appropriate security safeguards that the courts would employ.
I think that, yeah, it's a terrible case. Seville, I think, could probably speak volumes on this far more than I can. But what shocks me is the fact that, not only shocks me, I think it shocks the number of the judges, is the fact that the Obama administration didn't change their policy one iota from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. The Justice Department went in and argued their first case, I think it was like January or February, very soon after the Obama administration took office.
Yep.
And they argued, they used the same arguments that they used during the Bush administration. The judge in one of the cases in California involving state secrets said, are you sure that's your case? I mean, words to the effect of, are you sure that's your argument? Have you checked with Washington? They couldn't believe they were hearing the same argument. And neither could a lot of the people, you know, in this American Civil Liberties Union and other people who actually supported Obama in the election.
Jim, I'm glad we're at this infamous topic of the change. What were you hoping for with the administration change, at least as far as the NSA is concerned?
Well, what I was hoping for was that, first of all, the Obama administration would take a very close look at NSA and make the change that were necessary to be made. And thus far, they have not only haven't looked at it, they haven't made any changes whatsoever. Obama campaigned on the promise that he was going to filibuster against granting immunity to the telecom companies for their participation, the legal participation in this illegal eavesdropping. And then when push came to shove last summer, basically, when the bill came up to be voted on, he not only didn't filibuster against it, he voted in favor of it. So, yeah, I mean, it was a sign of things to come. It's been very disappointing, and I haven't seen any changes at NSA. As a matter of fact, as I just mentioned at the beginning of the program, he's expanding the NSA tremendously by...
Were you surprised that Hayden remained in his position?
Well, Hayden, when Obama came in, Hayden was let go from the CIA. He was one of the ones who weren't kept on by Obama. I mean, he replaced Hayden with Panetta. So I was glad to see Hayden go. That was one of the more positive aspects. He didn't give any fig leaf to Hayden. He didn't give him some, you know, the Medal of Freedom or these kind of things that they did for George Tenet when he left.
I think it's maybe too early to count our chicken.
You're listening to Boiling Frogs with me, Peter B. Collins, and Sibel Edmonds. Our guest is James Bamford, the author of The Shadow Factory and a number of other books regarding the National Security Agency. And as we mentioned earlier, Jim Bamford also was a producer and writer and lead anchor on the Nova special broadcast on February 3rd of this year called The Spy Factory. And Jim, in the book and in the Nova video piece, you went into great detail, and I'd like to focus on two particular aspects. One is the failure of three key agencies to coordinate information prior to 9/11, that being that Michael Scheuer was on camera with you describing how the CIA could not get critical information from the NSA, and they went to some lengths to create their own eavesdropping system. But they were only able to get half of the conversation, and they even sent transcripts of their half of the conversation to the NSA saying, well, look, we've got this. Can you help us out and give us the rest? NSA said no. Likewise, FBI was not permitted. There, you have an agent who, after the fact, in any case, was fairly courageous about talking about this, saying that he was not permitted to pick up the phone and share information. He was an FBI agent who was in a liaison position with, I don't recall, NSA or CIA, but he was not permitted to share that information with his superiors. So I'd like you to comment on agency coordination and to the extent that that may be better or worse with the new superstructure that was created with the National Intelligence Director. And secondly, I'd like you to describe in a little detail what you were able to trace to a safe house in Sana'a, Yemen. But first, talk a little bit about agency coordination.
Well, I thought it was extraordinary when I was looking into this, the fact that the NSA, which had picked up the first indication of the 9/11 plot when it eavesdropped on a phone call in Yemen from this house that operated as bin Laden's operations center in Yemen, in December of 1999. And the CIA was very interested in getting whatever the NSA could get from that house. It did pass on that one message, December 1999 message. The CIA wanted everything that the NSA was picking up from that house, that house in Yemen that served as bin Laden's operations and logistics and communications center. Mike Scheuer was the chief of what was known as the Alec Station, which was the bin Laden unit, CIA. And he went up to NSA numerous times, even met with the head of operations at NSA and practically demanded the NSA pass on that information from that house. Because, I mean, this was his bailiwick. It was, he was the guy in charge of trying to find out everything he could on bin Laden, and NSA listened to bin Laden's operations center. So Scheuer said that he was refused every single time, so the CIA, at the request of Scheuer, extraordinarily built their own intercept facility. But all they could pick up was the downlink. Since they didn't have any satellites that were capable of picking up the uplink, they could only get half the conversation. And when Scheuer went back to NSA and said, now, we can get half. Can you at least give us the other half? And again, they refused. This is all pre-9/11. What happened was after, in December of 1999, when NSA did pick up that communication, that one communication, passed it off to CIA, what the CIA was able to do was to get a copy of one of the key terrorist passports, Khalid al-Midar's passport, and they discovered by having that passport photographed that he had a visa, an active visa to come to the United States. That was passed on immediately to Alec Station. This is after Scheuer left. And the FBI agent in there, one of the FBI agents in there, Mark Rossini, in the CIA's Alec Station, he was assigned there temporarily as a liaison, said this should be passed on immediately to the FBI. I mean, here you have two terrorists that are on the way to the United States. I mean, they have visas for the United States. They wouldn't have visas if they weren't coming to the United States. And numerous times, I think at least two or three times, the CIA official in that office refused to allow the FBI agents to send that memo to FBI headquarters. Had they done that, they could have, two things could have happened. One, they could have stopped the initial two terrorists as they were entering the United States in Los Angeles. And what would have been even better, since they knew they were coming into the United States at that point, they could have secretly eavesdropped on their communications. They could have easily gotten a foreign intelligence surveillance warrant on them since they were being sent by bin Laden's operations center. And had they eavesdropped on their communications in San Diego, they would have discovered the whole plot because both Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi were communicating back and forth to both the Middle East and to Muhammad Atta and the other terrorists on the East Coast. So they would have picked up the whole thing.
And one of the big...
But it was this enormous lack of cooperation, the NSA not giving information to the CIA not giving information to the FBI, and so forth.
And one of the most embarrassing things that you disclose in the NOVA program, the Spy Factory, is that a group of the alleged hijackers spent the last 2 weeks before 9/11 in a cheesy motel within a couple of miles of the NSA headquarters at Fort Meade.
Well, that's right. Among the documents I got were a lot of documents that had been released under the Freedom of Information Act, and one of them was a very thick chronology. It was almost a minute-by-minute chronology. It was formerly secret. It was prepared by the FBI, so I knew virtually every move they made for the whole time they were in the United States. And we traced their path across the United States, every phone booth they went to. And it was really extraordinary. They ended up building their final command center, or their final base of operations, in the same town NSA is located, basically just across the bottom of Washington Parkway from where NSA is located.
Yeah, just amazing.
You have this one situation where you've got a major operations meeting of terrorists just across the street from a major operations meeting at NSA. NSA is trying to find them, and the terrorists are basically across the street. Muhammad Atta flew in. They actually took over three hotels for that meeting.
And, Jim, I've had the opportunity to interview Michael Scheuer on a number of occasions. He is the most polite man I have ever talked to. Every sentence ends with, sir. But I feel that most recently he's gone around some sort of a bend, because he has been quoted in the American media essentially inviting a serious attack from al-Qaeda because he believes that we've been lulled into complacency, and he kind of sounds like he's channeling Dick Cheney. What's your reaction to Scheuer's recent remarks?
Well, I've been following Scheuer for a very, very long time. Even while he was at the CIA, he was writing under a fictitious name. He actually did two books while he was there. So there's part of Scheuer that I agree with, and part of Scheuer that I completely disagree with. The part I agree with is some of his views on, well, certainly some of his views that I mentioned earlier on the lack of cooperation among the agencies, and some of his views on the Middle East. However, he on other views, I'm completely opposed, which are his views regarding rendition. He was actually one of the first people to get the CIA involved in, heavily involved in rendition. And so there's a number of issues I agree with him and a number of issues I don't agree with him.
Jim, you also mentioned the 9/11 Commission and the fact that they did not interview two very important FBI agents who were assigned to the Bin Laden unit, and these were agents Rossini and Doug Miller. Did you find out why and how that happened?
Well, I thought the commission did a horrible job. I spent a lot of time looking into what the commission was doing, and I just was astonished at how poorly a job they were doing. They not only didn't interview Mark Rossini and his partner at the CIA. I mean, I can't think of two more people you'd want to interview than the two FBI agents who were in the CIA's Bin Laden Center at the time everything was happening. Yet they didn't interview them. And then I also discovered that they never investigated NSA's role in the entire 9/11. My book was reviewed in the Washington Post by Bob Kerry, the former senator from Nebraska, who was on the 9/11 Commission. And he said my book went well beyond what the commission investigated and what other investigative reporters had come up with thus far. So, I mean, you know, the fact that an author can just out there on his own come up with more than what this entire commission was able to do with all the millions of dollars they had and, you know, enormous amount of staff. What apparently happened was that the commission had no interest in NSA whatsoever. The staff tried to get NSA, tried to get the staff to look at NSA records, and they just had only an interest interest in looking at the CIA. Staffers had mentioned that they thought it was looking at the CIA was a sexy thing to look at, and looking at NSA was sort of a lot of people with computers, and they didn't really understand it. So, I mean, it was a terrible investigation, I thought.
Indeed. I was there for a few days observing the work of the 9/11 Commission, and I was similarly appalled. And in retrospect, I've interviewed a number of people, members of the FAA Red Team. They were in charge of security at airports and knew what the status was of those efforts. They never really paid any attention to those who profited by betting against airline stocks in the week before 9/11 with stock options that were intended to make a big profit if airline stocks dropped precipitously. Those are just a couple of examples, and I have no confidence, really, in the ultimate product of the 9/11 Commission.
Neither do I.
Well, I actually interviewed Lee Hamilton, the one of the co-chairmen of the committee, and I asked him, did you ever interview Mike Hayden, the head of the NSA? And he couldn't even remember whether he interviewed him. This is the head of the largest intelligence agency in the country, and the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission couldn't remember whether they interviewed him or not. It was just extraordinary.
We're talking with James Bamford here on Boiling Frogs. I'm Peter B. Collins, along with Sibel Edmonds. And, Jim, you were awarded the 2005 National Magazine Award for Reporting for a lengthy piece that you wrote for Rolling Stone called The Man Who Sold the War. It was about John Rendon and his company, the Rendon Group. And as you detail in that article, the Rendon Group received a number of pricey, presumably no-bid contracts from the Pentagon over the period of time from the first Gulf War up through our invasion of Iraq. And in particular, Rendon has the dubious distinction of helping Chalabi, Ahmed Chalabi, who was this expatriate who was hell-bent on any way of taking Saddam Hussein out of power. He had eyes on being the ruler of Iraq himself. And Rendon created this INC, the Iraqi National Congress, which was receiving over $300,000 a month from the Pentagon until, or actually from the CIA, and then the CIA soured on them, and they moved the account over to the Pentagon. Rendon considers him himself a specialist in perception management. Give us some examples and details of what Rendon was responsible for in selling the American public via propaganda the Bush War in Iraq.
Well, when I started working on this article, I was really I had no idea, and I was really astonished to discover that that it was the entire Iraqi National Congress, the INC, was a creation of an advertising agency, basically, based in Washington and funded by the CIA. Most people seemed or most people's perception of it would be that it was an indigenous organization that had its origins in just the people associated with it in Iraq. But it wasn't. It was John Rendon went over there at the behest of the CIA, pulled all these sort of disparate groups together at a conference in Vienna, Austria, and came up with the name Iraqi National Congress, which sounds very democratic. You can't get more democratic sounding than that. And then put this one person in charge, who was seemed to be the most charismatic and had a lot of influence with the U.S. Neoconservatives, Ahmed Chalabi. And from then on, they first tried to pull together a coup, or not a coup, but an internal overthrow of the Saddam government. That didn't work. And then from then on, it was they decided the only way that there was ever going to be a overthrow of the Saddam government was not internally with their own overthrow, but with a external war by the United States. And that that was the reason why they pushed and Chalabi, came up with all these defectors that have phony information about weapons of mass destruction. His main goal was to get the United States to launch a war, overthrow Saddam Hussein, and let Chalabi move in as president of the country.
Jim, I know things have been kind of quiet on Randon's side, but these guys, these propaganda machines on contract, they are like hydras. So one goes away and becomes quiet, and there are about six or seven taking one's place. And with what we see, or what we got to see in the past couple of months with Iran, for me, especially since I have read this article of yours three times, just fantastic article, seems like a footprint of another propaganda machine. What does it look like to you?
Well, thanks, Abel. Yeah, I appreciate it. Well, that's what worries me, too. I mean, you've got the government, it's been acknowledged that the U.S. Government is funding a secret propaganda war in Iran, you know, using money from Congress. This got started under the Bush administration. And then you wonder, where does that lead? And you know, if you're talking about propaganda, the lead figure, at least when I was doing the research of the Iraq War, was John Rendon, in terms of having his company do a lot of that work. So I have no idea whether Rendon's doing any work in Iran, you know, that's the kind of work that he did in Iraq. And what worries me about Iran is the, you know, this whole thing started so long ago in 1952 with the U.S. Ousting an elected president of Iran, Mossadegh. And, you know, I'd hate to see the United States become involved in one way or another of the election that just took place in Iran, because, again, it would cast the United States as doing very similar things that was done in the Eisenhower administration.
That makes it two of us, Peter. That makes it two of us.
And Jim, I was struck by a remarkable comment that President Obama made in his speech in Cairo, where he was the first American official to publicly acknowledge that we did overthrow the Mossadegh is how you would pronounce it in Farsi, I guess.
Mossadegh, yes.
Thank you. The government back in 52 or 53. What do you see as the strategy behind that? Was that an effort to disarm opponents by acknowledging America's role way back there?
Well, I think it's just being honest. I think it's just no question that we did it. There's been numerous books written about how it was done and what took place. But I think, I think that's one of the things that Obama's should be doing is acknowledging the mistakes of the past and then making sure we don't do it in the future. You had all the during the last election, you had enormous amounts of people on the far right. I mean, you had John McCain coming out swinging, saying all this belligerent talk about how we should be condemning Iran and all this stuff. You know, what we should be doing is backing away from some of these countries that are having elections and let them have the elections. The United States has this history of pushing for elections, and then when they elect somebody, like in Palestine, they elected Hamas was the people that won the election, and then the Bush administration did everything to crush Hamas. So, you know, we've got this history of pushing for elections, and then when it doesn't turn out the way we want, we do everything we can to overthrow the election. It's just the absolutely wrong message we should be sending to these countries. Just step back and let them do their thing, and then, you know, fix bridges, do a few things in the United States, find a cure for cancer, do something useful with some of this money instead of, you know, launching wars.
Well said.
Jim Bamford, thank you for joining us here on our premiere edition of Boiling Frogs. And let me just ask you for a final comment. What would you like our listeners to take away from this discussion? What to you is the most important thing they need to know about our national security apparatus?
Well, I think there's really two things. One of them is that they've really got to put pressure on the Obama administration to live up to what a lot of people expected the Obama administration to do domestically, which was to correct a lot of the abuses that we have in terms of intelligence. Instead of adopting the Bush administration's policies, change the Bush administration's policies to policies that are not so violative of U.S. Civil liberties. And then secondly, I think they've got to start putting pressure on the Obama administration to begin changing U.S. policy overseas. I mean, we're finally getting out of Iraq, and we're just moving into Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan's absurd, this whole war. The war just doesn't make any sense to me in terms of what we're doing over there. And we're killing so many people with the drones. I think there's got to be pressure domestically on the Obama administration to take civil liberties more into consideration and take consideration overseas into pulling the U.S. out of Middle Eastern countries and de-escalating from wars instead of escalating wars.
And Jim, I want to thank you. It's an honor to have you as my first guest, as our first guest, and hope to have you back soon.
Well, it's a pleasure. This is fantastic. You're great questions, and there's a lot of time to answer them, which I don't usually get. I'm on for 3 minutes some places, and you can never answer them. So I really appreciate Sabel being on your show with you and Peter, and I hope you two have a very big success with your program. And thanks again for the honor of being the first guest on the program.
Well, and there's much more that Jim Bamford has disclosed. You need to read The Shadow Factory hardcover from Doubleday, and go to PBS.org and do a search for Nova, The Spy Factory. The original broadcast date was in February of 2009. James Bamford, thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks, Sabel.
Well, Sabel, Jim Bamford is an amazing guy with a wealth of information. And what I think is so remarkable is that all of the information that he has revealed to us is from public records and on-the-record interviews. He doesn't use a lot of unnamed sources, either in his book or in the PBS Nova program.
Right. And here is another thing. You know, with people like, Zimmer Hirsch and Bamford, they are able to go and get the facts and get the information and put it out there. So where are the rest of these reporters? I was looking at one of the interviews Zimmer Hirsch gave, and he was saying, well, I'm getting this information because I have access to people, and I just go and get it from them. My question is, so what, you only have two investigative journalists, a handful of investigative journalists? The rest of them are acting like these stenographers. They just sit down there, they take their telephone, pull out their phones, they call their source within the State Department or the White House and just write it away. And that's what they feed us.
Well, and as you pointed out in a recent post that you wrote in your project to expose the mainstream media, you went into explicit detail about the information that you personally delivered to Michael Isikoff, who has the reputation of being one of the tough investigative reporters on the beat of national security in Washington today. And he not only declined or refused to publish the information that you provided to him. He instead published denials from the FBI that he knew, well, he at least should have questioned their veracity, but based on the information you had supplied, he should have had serious questions about the contradictions that were quite evident and apparent to him at that point. But
I don't even know why he's considered serious investigative journalist, Peter. I mean, really, take a look at this man's record, okay? He's the man who chased the Monica Lewinsky story for more than 3 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That is his claim to fame. And if you talk to people, because, as you know, this is a pretty small circle, he is daydreaming to be the next Woodward when it comes to having access to the White House to write the president's book, as Woodward did. So, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
And when we hear the candid comments that Jim Bamford made and that I second, and I know you agree with, related to the work of the 9/11 Commission, it was a kind of public drama that they put on to pacify the survivors of 9/11 victims and those of us who were seeking the truth. But the most important thing to, I think, to take away from that is that however it happened, and I don't believe the official story that we've been told about 9/11, I'll put that aside for now, the point is that we were skunked on 9/11. Our defense systems, our NSA programs to monitor the behavior of those who threatened us, it was a complete and utter failure. And yet those most responsible got promoted.
Absolutely. And Peter, as he mentions in his writing regarding this, the 9/11 Commission not interviewing these people, another thing he mentions that the media has not covered this angle. These two FBI agents that were not interviewed. And as you said, here is James Bamford able to go out there and get this information and put it out there, confirm information. So where are the rest of these people?
Yeah. Well, they're chasing Michael Jackson stories, and they'll be diverted to that for quite a while, I'm afraid. And, of course, Republican sex scandals take precedent over the critical issues of our constitutional rights. It's really upside down, Sibel.
It is, and can't you feel? The water is boiling, Peter.
Well, Sibel, I really enjoyed co-hosting this first edition of Boiling Frogs with you, and this is the first of a series, so I hope people will, number one, continue to check back at the website to look for future editions of Boiling Frogs, and also we invite you to spread this information far and wide. Share it with your network of friends and email contacts, and see if we can't get the information out there and activate the public. Because, as I said at the start of this, I want my Fourth Amendment rights back, and I want full constitutional rule in this country. And we have slipped badly, particularly in the last 7 or 8 years, and we've got a lot of work to do to recover.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Sibel Edmonds.
Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews. Until then.